Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. Well, we're going to have a bit of a spooky show today, and my guest, Dr. Bob Coran, is in the UK, but we are going to be chatting with this book of his, which, believe me, when I saw it for the first time, I thought, nah, I'm not going to talk about zombies on there. But once I got into the book, I was so fascinated with it. Because of all the history, I thought, gee whiz, Halloween's just around the corner. We've got to talk about this fascinating aspect of history. And Dr. Bob Coran is on the air with me. Dr. Coran, welcome to the show.
Hello, Donna.
Hi.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing absolutely fabulous. I have to tell you, talking about zombies would have been the last thing on my list of to-do at any time. But your book, A Field Guide to the Walking Dead, I thought, I'm curious, and I started to read it, and I was fascinated with the history that you put into this book. History is a passion of yours, isn't it?
It is indeed, Donna. I lecture in history, so I suppose history and the sort of personal enthusiasm I have for the subject has got into that, into the book.
Well, absolutely. And that's what makes it so interesting. Now, my audience, I want them to know a little bit about you because you were born and raised in a remote mountain area of County Down in Northern Ireland. You left school at 14. You have done all kinds of jobs, everything from being a grave digger to being a scripter of comics. You traveled to so many different countries, ended up working in the civil service, and you finally went to university where you got degrees in education, history, educational psychology, and that evolved into your becoming a teacher. But you really have been so involved as a consultant with a number of cultural bodies within the province of Northern Ireland, and you have dealt with matters dealing with the Irish Republic. You've worked for the office of the First and Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. You've been a governmental advisor. I mean, it goes on and on. And you've written, when did you have the time to write 38 books? Good gracious.
You're making me sound more interesting than I actually am, Donna.
Well,
I work sort of, my day starts at 5 o'clock in the morning, Donna, and finishes, it is now 11 o'clock at night. It is, I usually finish at 12 o'clock at night over here. So, working, it's good life and wholesome thoughts, Donna.
Oh, absolutely. Now, let's get into this stuff on the zombies, because most of the time, when you talk about a zombie, people have this particular image of this grayish figure. Of course, American Hollywood movies have really done a great deal to promote this image of the Walking Dead, but I was fascinated, and I want you to define the Walking Dead for me, but I was fascinated with how it's culturally just not in one country. Give us a little background on how you got involved with this and why you decided you were going to do research on The Walking Dead, the zombies.
Well, the name Zombies was the publisher's choice for the book, and we thought it might grab the attention, so I went with it. It was simply a field guide to The Walking Dead originally. If I can start, Donna, with a small personal anecdote, and you mentioned one of my earliest incarnations was a grave digger. Now, I started grave digging whenever I left school, and the first job that I had here in Northern Ireland was what we call breaking graves. Now, that meant that you were working in the mountain parishes, which burial space was at a premium. And if there was an unmarked grave, and you consulted what was called an allotment book, which gave a record of the burials, and there had been no burials for 100 years, you were entitled to open that and use it for fresh burials. And a lot of people wouldn't open graves, but I was young and adventurous, so I agreed that I would do it. And we dug up things like coffin lids. Now, one of the coffin lids, which I dug up, had been lined on the inside, and it really scared me, because the lining on the inside of the coffin lid had been torn away, and the marks of the fingers were in the woodwork. Whoever had been buried there had been buried alive. And I suppose that was part of the idea behind, the cultural idea, anyway, behind the book. Because you're quite right, we tend to think of zombies as sort of shambling figures from Afro-Caribbean cultures. But Ireland, England, and America have traditions as well of the Walking Dead, possibly because of what were known as cataleptics. That meant that people went into comas and may have been pronounced dead and then came back again. And that may have fed the culture. As well as that, Donna, there's a psychological aspect, and I want to talk a wee bit about that. For us, death is the last great mystery. Nobody knows what lies beyond death. We can all hazard guesses, but nobody has definite proof. We can't say it's a life like our own, as the ancient Egyptians believed. They simply thought of death as a form of transition. And life continued pretty much as it was here, on the other side of the tomb. And that's why the pharaohs had all their jewels and their servants entombed with them and their favorite animals, so that everything would continue on the other side. And the ancient Celts as well had a place, although it was less well-defined. Once you began to speculate on what was on the other side of death, you then began to wonder, well, if people were dead and if they were a bit if life continued, was it possible to come back? Was it possible if it was simply a time of transition, could they actually come back across the divide and do things in our own world, in the world of the living? And the answer was maybe. And even the early church thought that it was possible to it might be possible to come back, and that God might allow you to come back. And I'm talking about the church in the Western sense.
Mm-hmm.
They argued that what they called the blessed dead, those who had died and were good and so forth, might come back and enjoy for a very limited period. And on certain nights of the year, and we're coming up to one of those nights of the year, the old Celtic festival of Samhain. You know it as Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly on those nights, the blessed dead might come back. And they might enjoy a brief period in the world and enjoy the things which they had enjoyed previously. Now, for example, I and my wife, Mary, were down in southwest Fermanagh about 5 or 6 years ago. And we were talking to an old man who lived down there. And a very respectable old man, a pillar of the church locally, and very well thought of in the area. And he told us a story about his grandfather coming back from the dead. And he came back on Halloween night. And he said he lifted the latch. The old gentleman at this time was a very, very young boy. And he said the corpse just lifted the latch and walked in and sat down at the fire. Just as he had in his lifetime. And the gentleman's mother had a glass of whiskey for him and his pipe. And he smoked the pipe and he drank a glass of whiskey. And the only difference was that he didn't speak. He seemed to be incapable of speech, but he enjoyed everything that was going all around him, and they played music for him, and they sang for him, and they danced, and sometimes they gave him a bite to eat. And I said, "George, were you not frightened of him?" He said, "Why should I be frightened of him? It was my own grandfather." And he told me about climbing up on the corpse's knee and touching the skin and finding it very cold. And whenever the evening was over, the family went on to bed and left him sitting there. And in the morning, he was gone. And this happened, the old gentleman said, for 2 or 3 years. And he came back all the time. He seemed paler. He gradually seemed paler as he came back, but he came back for, let's say, a couple of years anyway. When the old gentleman involved went out into the kitchen to get us some tea, Mary, my wife, said, "You know, he's pulling your leg." And I said, "Mary, why should he? I mean, he's a very respectable old man. He's not trying to pull the wool over our eyes, I don't think." And he told us other things, which other people had corroborated. And he said, "Come on down, we'll talk to my sister." So he took us down to his sister and said, "What about my grandfather?" And she says, "Come on back from the tomb." And he said, "Yes." And she told us exactly the same story. And that was where the blessed dead came back. Now, once again, in other cultures, we tend to think about Haiti, and maybe we'll talk about Haiti later on. But we tend to think, in other cultures, like, let's say, Mexico, they have set a day aside, a day of the dead, when the dead return. And they enjoy a lot of the things and a lot of the carnival and a lot of the fiesta. It's a very joyful day. And they enjoy the time. And the dead are supposed to return. And this is a part of the culture. Other cultures have it, and some of the Scandinavian cultures, they have exactly the same. So the Blessed Dead return. Now, there was another element to it, and this came from the Western Church. The Western Church said, because it made money out of the saying of masses for the dead, they said, if you can, if you forget to say your masses, the dead will come back and remind you, which is really part of what Halloween is all about. Because over here, we think that the dead come back to remind people to say masses for them in the church. And, of course, they paid the priest. And the priest would say, well, if you forget, the dead might come back and take vengeance on you for not doing it, because it condemns them to another year in purgatory. So the two beliefs, the blessed dead came back to enjoy the world as they had, and the vengeful dead, or the unquiet dead, came back to take vengeance for those masses which were left unsaid. So there is a sort of history in the West and in cultures beyond Haiti where the dead return.
It is so fascinating, all of the different points of information that you give, but there are the stories, and your relationship to the walking dead and people being in comas. And being, in fact, they had the bell. Someone came up with the invention
of
putting
right.
a string in the coffin where they could ring a bell if they were still alive, because
that's
they didn't
right.
have the medical knowledge that we have today. And let's face it, even today we have a difficult time.
That's right.
Diagnosing.
Indeed, because they, and you're right about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in a great house here in Ireland in which there was a bell attached to a tomb. And that was because, and the cataleptics, the family was subject to catalepsy, which was a state where the breathing became so shallow, the pulse slowed almost to an imperceptible level, and to all intents and purposes, they were pronounced dead. They came, as I was, as in the story that I told you about digging up the coffin, they came to within the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And the bell, you're quite right, was attached. That's where we get the two expressions, saved by the bell and a dead ringer.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes, so the bell was there to make sure that whoever was in the tomb and they came to could summon help. So you're absolutely right.
That brings up one of the tales that you have in your book. And by the way, for those of you listening, we're talking with Dr. Bob Curran, and he is in the UK. We are discussing his book on zombies, and it's not the Hollywood version stuff. This is really some fascinating history about legends, traditions, how they evolved, and they've been around for thousands of years, not just recently, but for thousands of years in different cultures. Tell us about Constance Whitney. Now, this
Constance Whitney.
This was terrific. Well,
this was actually quite a common story. Constance Whitney is the one figure to whom a scroll, an ornamental scroll, has been attached on the wall of St. Giles Cripplegate. And Constance Whitney was a very wealthy woman who seemed to die and was placed in her coffin and left within the church. Now, as I said, she was quite a wealthy woman, and she was buried in all her finery. On one of her fingers was a large ring. Now, as they were closing the coffin lid, the sexton, who operated in the church and was a very greedy man, noticed the ring and resolved to have it, if he could. So whenever the mourners had gone and the lid was not finally screwed down, that would be done the following day, the sexton went over to the coffin and unscrewed the entire lid, and there was Constance Whitney lying in her coffin. And he took out a knife, and he tried to prise the ring off the finger. As he did so, he cut the skin slightly, and a small pearl of blood that came up. Constance Whitney's eyelids fluttered, and she sat up in the coffin.
I love it.
The sexton ran for life and was later arrested for that. But Constance Whitney went on to live for a good number of years. Now, on the scroll, which is an ornamental scroll placed on the wall of the St. Giles Church, it shows her sitting up in her coffin. And that is an actual, at the end of the 1800s, that is an actual attested story. It is not uncommon. There, where I am speaking to you from, about 11 miles down the road, in Ballycastle, there is an actual similar story, where the woman was actually buried and dug up again, and the coffin opened, and once again the ring rings were tried to be prized from the fingers, and the woman came too. Now, that was not uncommon. And as you were quite rightly saying, Donna, it can happen even today, because not so long ago, I was reading in the paper where in England, an embalmer's assistant was ready to embalm the corpse, and he noticed it was a lady. And he noticed the eyelids fluttering. And he placed a mirror over the nostril. And there was the faintest mist of a breath. And they brought a doctor, and the lady came too. And she's still living.
Amazing. Most of them are women.
Well, men too. But the story is much better, Donna, if they're trying to prize rings from the fingers.
I gotcha. Well, maybe the gal just got so tired she figured she needed a rest, and somebody thought she was dead. She was
possibly that was it. You're absolutely right.
Anyway, but we've got to get into the body snatchers, because this is absolutely documented, the body snatching that was done. And it was, you know, grave robbing. It was done for the medical community. And you have some amazing details on this. Grave robbing started when? In the 1700s?
The 1700s. Now, you're quite right once again, Donna. You've been reading my book, you see.
Yes, aha.
As medicine began to develop and expand into the future, and as more and more people became involved in this, it became very fashionable for young gentlemen to become surgeons. The problem for the medical profession was a shortage of bodies because they depended on executions. And they were entitled, here in England and in America, they were entitled to only a certain number of bodies of executed people who were not claimed by their own families. So there was a shortage of bodies. And what they began to do, and there were a number of organized gangs operating in close to the schools of surgery, in places like London, in places like Edinburgh, and in places like Dublin, and I suspect in places like Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually dealt. It actually became a very lucrative profession in which you brought up bodies. You sold them to the surgeons who then used them for either experimental purposes to see how the blood circulated in the body and looked at circulatory systems and things like that, or used them for demonstration to their students. And there were very famous people who dealt in the bodies from the surgeon side. The famous Dr. Robert Knox in Edinburgh, who bought from the body snatchers Burke and Hare, or Dr. Samuel Clossie in Dublin, who bought from the body snatcher Crazy Crow, or Billy in the Basin.
Mm-hmm.
Billy in the Basin was quite was actually a murderer who sold these bodies on and strangled. He had no legs and he travelled about in the basin and begged on the streets, and whenever you bent down to give him a penny, he might strangle you.
Mm-hmm.
And sell your body on. So that was. There was also a very interesting phenomenon which were known as the half-hanged and became a medical phenomenon. Whenever you were hanged, it depended on your neck being broken. Now, that was not always the case. And, for instance, the last hangman in England, Alfred Pierpoint, went and checked the weight of, always met the people he was about to hang, and he checked their weight, and he checked the size of their bodies and stuff like that so that the neck would break. But that, before that, that wasn't always the case. Because what sometimes happened was that the noose came down, the neck didn't break, and the person who was being hanged was sort of half strangled by the rope. Some of them were completely strangled by the rope. But some of them were not. And some of them were cut down and revived and became what were known as the half-hanged. Now, in the 1700s in Edinburgh, there was a very famous case of Margaret Dixon. Margaret Dixon was hanged for the murder, the alleged murder of a young child. And she was hanged in the grass market in Edinburgh. And she was cut down from the gallows and placed on a cart to be taken to the mortuary by the hangman and a mortuary attendant. Now, they travelled over the cobbled streets of Edinburgh, jerking about and throwing the body from one. They assumed that she was dead and they showed little scant respect for the body. Halfway along, they stopped by a pub and decided to go in and have a drink. So they went in and had a drink, and while they were in, the body of Margaret Dixon came too and got up on the back of the cart. After all the jiggling about that had been done, she had revived her, and she got up and went home, to the amazement and terror of the people round about, and even more so to the terror and amazement of her husband.
I bet.
Who had actually declared himself a widower and was claiming a pension on the strength of it. And he had to go under the Scottish law and remarry her. So it was like remarrying a corpse. And this became the subject of a very ribald song, which was sung in all the pubs and taverns around Edinburgh and further afield. So, but the half-hanged were an interesting, and this all contributed to a culture. There was also a gentleman who lived in Newgate called Half-Hanged Harding, who had been revived similarly and been brought in, revived by smelling salts, and spent his days in Newgate in jail, and received visitors, and became a great wonder. People actually paid to come in and see him and talk to him. Some of the half-hanged, because the blood supply had been cut off to the brain, were left slightly mentally weak.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that also feeds in to the idea of the zombie where you have, or the walking dead where you have the figure shambling along the road and things like that. So you had all these images coalescing into various figures of the walking dead and therefore into the culture.
Right, and then there was the movie that was made in 1968, The Night of the Living Dead, that was directed by George Romero, and that created, you might say, a zombie culture. And, of course, you have the Caribbean, where it has a lot of what's called the voodoo and the walking dead, and there was research that was done because someone, and I don't remember who it was, that had discovered that there was a toxin that was given to people that created a physiological, almost like a cataleptic state for an individual. And you have in here a story about a man who was that way for 16 years.
Yes.
And that was in the Caribbean. You have all of these interesting stories that are in here. And, of course, for those of you listening, you've got to know that if you wanted to scare the pants off of anybody, this is a good way to do it. I mean, he has got some wonderful stories, and they're true. This is not made up. This is historical fact. Now, Bob, I know we're just about out of time, and you have got so many wonderful points of information in here that I think are just truly amazing. How long did it take you to do the research on this?
The research has been ongoing, Donna, for a number of years. Now, I haven't traveled, and I will admit that I haven't traveled to Haiti, but I have been in your part of the world. I have been in places like New Orleans and Charleston and places like that where, even in America, the sort of zombie culture flourishes. And we're almost out of time, but I've been to Japan and talked to people who have met the mysterious living mummies, which are found in the northern end of Japan, which were a symbol of the holiness of certain monks and ascetics. So it was an ongoing. It took me almost a year to write the book. We did the book in about 7 or 8 months. But the research and I had already done a book for the same publisher on vampires, and a lot of the stuff came over into that. It's part of a lifetime's work, and it was a labor of love, Donna.
Oh, I believe that, just from the way it was written. It's just utterly fascinating. I want to close out our interview. By the way, you do have a website, don't you, Dr. Curran?
I don't have I'm in the process of having a website built, but I'm backwards and forwards. But if people want to send me a question or do anything like that, I will give the email address, and it's drbobcurran@yahoo.co.uk. And if they send me a question, I will do my best to answer it.
Well, that's delightful. I want to close with the last paragraph in one of the chapters of your book. The returning dead, therefore, appear in the lore and traditions of many cultures all across the world from ancient times to the present day. Their presence signals the belief that death is not the ultimate end and that something lies beyond. They also give an assurance that humans are immortal and that they can, if need be, return to reassure or perhaps to comfort or advise those whom they have left behind. They are also the last vestiges of vanished cultures and arcane beliefs. reminding subsequent generations of all that has gone before. And as such, they continue to haunt our minds, whether it be through continuing beliefs in tales or in celluloid form, and perhaps will do so for many years to come. Dr. Curran, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Your book,
Zombies. It was a pleasure to talk to you, Donna. It really was.
Thank you. A Field Guide to the Walking Dead. This is Donna Sebo. You got to be prepared for Halloween, folks. You got to have some good material to share with people. You need to add this to your library. Zombies, A Field Guide to the Walking Dead. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go away. More good things to share.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to call in and chat, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here are the telephone numbers, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. Now, if you're a first-time listener, all you need to do is when you call in, give me your first name or your initial, let me respond, and then after that, you can ask me a question about anything that you're interested in. I'm often, when I'm interacting with people, they ask, how many books do I read a year? Because they know that I have The Daily Show, and I'll say, well, anywhere from 400 to 600 books a year. And usually they gasp when they hear that. They say, I'm lucky if I read one a month. And I know I'm a little bit unusual because of the volume of reading that I do, but it really is something that makes it more interesting for me when I go to do the interviews, knowing that the material that I've gone through, whether it's about zombies or CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, etc., it doesn't make any difference. Having the accurate information and knowing about it is very, very important. Well, I have dedicated and have donated a lot of books to libraries, and that is because, my gracious, I've gone through about 2,000 books in the years that I've had my show, which is getting close to 8 years now. So that is a lot of material. And so you can't, unless you have a house you can just put all your books in, then you're going to run out of space fairly quickly. So libraries have been enriched by all of the materials that I have, by much of the materials that I've gotten. And I found out about a woman who really was an avid reader herself, and she passed away a short time ago. And one of the members of her family, when going through all of the books that she had acquired, wrote down every single title. And he didn't get rid of any of them until he sent the information about all the books that were in her library to every member of the family. And that included the grandkids, and said, I want you to tell me what books you would like to have from this, from my wife's library, because I'm not going to keep them, but I want you to have first opportunity. Well, they were just thrilled. All of the members of the family said, well, if it had been with anybody else, we might not have even had the opportunity to go through the books, but she will know, wherever she is, that all of her books are going to find a home in the family itself. And so all the family members went over, went through all the books, and they all ended up taking the books home. So it was quite a good-sized family. And those that they didn't want, they did what I do, and they went and dedicated them to the public library so that others can enjoy them. Books are one of the most wonderful things that we can ever acquire. And I know over 30 years ago, when I yearned for a library, I had some books. I didn't have many. And I absolutely have always treasured books. And I got a call from a client of mine, and she said, Donna, I was just called by an attorney, and this attorney said that he has access to the library of an elderly lady who had just died, and she didn't leave any instructions about this massive library she had acquired. She had like 5,000 books. Now, Gwen was the woman that called me, and she said, I know how much you love books, and there is this huge metaphysical library that this woman acquired, and I've already gone through the books, and I've picked out what I want, but I'd like to call you first so that you can pick out what you want. Well, the books were going for a dollar, and what Gwen did, because the attorney just gave her all the books from this library, 5,000 books, and said, this is a good way for you to raise money for your soccer team. And all you need to do is just let people know that this library is available and let them come in and pick out what they want. Well, I ended up coming home with about 100 books that went into my metaphysical library, which I treasured because they had been written a long time before, and many of them, they're very, very difficult to find today. So Gwen gave me a wonderful gift. I was able, by buying the books, to support her soccer team, of which her children were very much involved with. And then she called all kinds of people, because this individual had books on gardening. They were just phenomenal. Oh, you name it, she had it. This woman's library was just amazing. So Gwen ended up getting money for the soccer team, but those that finally she was not able to find a home for, then those went to her local library as well. And in today's world, we don't seem to appreciate the libraries as much as we should. And so if you have books, or if you have anything that you no longer wish to have in your personal library, magazines, whatever, talk to your local library so that they can give you a receipt. And when you take your books in, they'll give you a receipt so you can get a tax deduction for giving them the books. But they have even book sales that help raise money for the libraries. And a lot of libraries are really suffering. But all of the libraries offer the opportunity for anyone to go in and to be able to get books for free, to take them out. And, of course, lots of times books wear out. They're used so much. So this is something that's a wonderful thing to remember. And just like this lady that I was talking about, where when she passed away, her husband asked the family who wanted some of the books. These are wonderful, wonderful gifts that people need to know when they have treasured their libraries as they have to pass them on. And you never know when you might find something that's going to be especially significant. I have found some wonderful treasures in Goodwill stores with books and libraries. I mean, it's just amazing. Secondhand bookstores. And I think our love for books continues to grow. Every time they try to make it an electronic medium, it just seems so difficult for so many of us to adapt to that. Because holding a book in your hand and turning its pages are totally, totally magical. But anyway, keep that in mind. If you have books you no longer wish to have, if there's no one around you that's interested in the subject matter that you have, take them to your Goodwill, your thrift stores. Go to the library. They'll give you receipts so you can make a tax donation, get a tax receipt. And it's just going to be absolutely wonderful. You'll know that those books have had a home. Not too long ago, I was reviewing information and material where in different environments they are burning books. And that, to me, is just abhorrent. Why? Because whenever you take away the opportunity for someone to be educated, to read, to learn, that means that we're a step closer to being made into a slave, made into a servant of somebody else's thinking who wants to dictate to us what we desire. If I sound a little melodramatic, well, I guess I mean that to be that way. It is important for us to remember that we have the right to choose what we want to read, and having public libraries that are homes for written materials are very, very significant. So just keep my suggestions in mind, and I hope you will pass yours on, whatever that might be. Donna Sebo here. Give me a call if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of insight. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756 and 530 876-3222. Well, if you're like most of us, you're concerned about how much gas you're going to be buying and the cost of gasoline, and yes, we've seen some prices go down, but they're still relatively high to what they were in the past. So if you want to gas up for less, try using cash instead of a credit card the next time you fill up. And I know there are stations in our neighborhood where you can save as much as 14 cents a gallon, because if you pay in cash, they will give you a very good break. And there are some gas stations, I know, that's all that they're taking. They won't take credit cards, because every time they have a credit card processed, they have to pay a fee to that creditor that's being represented. So stations' fees have gone up just as much as the gas prices have. So all of those things just keep in mind. So to keep your costs down, check out those stations that are offering discounts to those who use cash. And if you find one near you, that's great. If you don't know how to find one, then go to this website, GasBuddy.com. That's GasBuddy.com. And you'll be able to find out about a station that's close to you, a gasoline station, and it'll save you a little bit here and a little bit there. Of course, every penny counts, as the old saying goes. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about UFOs over New York. Preston Dennett is going to be my guest. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking with Nancy Perezzo. We're going to be talking about pioneer women, intellectuals way ahead of their time, revisioning the American West and designing their own frontier. So I think we've got some fascinating subject matter. And then next week, we're going to be talking with Dr. Susan Silverstein. We're going to be talking about Hungry for Health, and we're going to be talking about breast cancer. And there is a breast cancer kit that she's going to be sharing information with us about. Also, the Freedom Formula. Christine Klosser is going to be my guest on next Tuesday. The Book of the Bizarre. Varla Ventura is going to be my guest next Wednesday. Our Energetic Evolution in Healing, Cynthia O'Neill, is going to be our guest. And then on Halloween, we're going to have an open mic, and I'll be sharing some stories with you and some other fun things. And it is just going to be a real dynamic week next week, and I hope you will join us. And also tell your friends about the show. We're taking a break for just a moment. We'll be back in just a minute. Those phone lines are open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. We'll be right back.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. I know you just heard the ad regarding my children's book, God's Kiss. I wanted to let you know that because of the holidays coming up, I'm offering a special discount to those of you who are listening. If you have children from the ages of 3 to 10, this is a wonderful holiday package, and I'm offering a special discount of $15. And I will personalize them for you and autograph them. And this is something that, again, I'll be doing all the way through until just before Christmas. So if you would like to get that special gift for that child that you just know would love to have a magical story for the holidays, then do give me a buzz at my office, 800-872-8852. That's 800-872-8852. I wanted to share some information about elections. Yes, they're coming up. It's just around the corner. We've got a very significant election ahead of us. And I wanted to share some points of information that were brought to my attention, and I may share some of these with you during the next few days as well. Did you know that ancient Greece was not the birthplace of democracy? Apparently, democracy existed a good 2,000 years earlier in the kingdom of Ebla. It was located in what we now know as Syria, and kings were elected for seven-year terms. Fascinating information. I didn't know that. So that was a piece of detail that was of interest to me. Humans are not the only ones that vote. Did you know that nature, there are those creatures in nature that do something similar? And could you imagine what creature it might be? Try the honeybees. That's right. They vote for best location. Now, they may not be able to count as we count, but apparently scouts, after they return from checking out possible sites for relocation, they dance. And what they've noticed in this observation of these fascinating creatures, the bees that dance most vigorously will recruit other scouts until one site wins. Sounds a little familiar in technique, wouldn't you agree? And also, I wanted to give you some information about an election in 1952, and this was all about Walter Cronkite. Of course, this man is a legend in television, but they saw in 1952 Walter Cronkite sitting beside UNIVAC 1, which famously called the race for Eisenhower after only 7% of the vote had been tallied. But that's not the whole truth. Walter Cronkite sat beside a cardboard panel with blinking Christmas lights, the real computer that was giving all the information, projecting returns, was located in Pennsylvania. Just a little bit of trivia there for you. And it is amazing that in 2007, neuroscientists examined the brain activity of voters that were not too decisive, they hadn't made up their mind, as they were trying to evaluate the presidential candidates for the race. And this is what they came up with, the neuroscientists did. The two candidates who elicited the least amount of activity is John McCain and Barack Obama. Oh, well, they're the neuroscientists, so we'll just have to let them tell us how they worked on that one. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Telephone number to call in to is 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. 888-815-9756 if you're in Canada, and 530-876-3222. I don't know about you, but with Halloween coming up and we're entering into the season where entertaining and having guests over is always something special. You might want to think about having something real simple and easy. How about spinach dip? Now, I have not found many people making this up, but boy, is it good. And I came across a recipe that I thought you might enjoy because it's so easy to fix. It's really, really simple. And what you're going to need are the following ingredients. You're going to need one container of 16 ounces of reduced fat sour cream, or you can use the real stuff, whatever you prefer. Non-fat or real fat sour cream. One package of frozen chopped spinach, thawed, and you need to squeeze it dry. And I would recommend when you're draining it, put it in cheesecloth so that you can really squeeze out all of that moisture. And if you want, just save the moisture and put it in a soup or something if you like. You're going to need two scallions chopped, real finely, and then 3 tablespoons of dry salad seasoning. And there's all kinds of various salad seasonings that you can pick up. Choose the one you like the best. 2 tablespoons of grated Parmesan cheese. 2 tablespoons of grated Parmesan cheese, 1/4 teaspoon of garlic powder, and 1 10-inch round of loaf crusty bread. And sometimes at bakeries you can get the unbaked sourdough, and it comes in those nice circular loaves, and they're one of my favorites. And you bake that until it takes about 10 minutes when you put it in a 350-degree oven, and makes a real nice crispy crust. And if you want it extra crispy, just maybe baste the unbaked loaf with a little bit of water, and it'll get nice, nice crust. So all you do is take all of the ingredients, your sour cream, your thawed, squeezed dry spinach, scallions, dry salad seasoning, Parmesan cheese, garlic powder, mix it all up, and you want to refrigerate it for at least 2 hours. And if you wanted to, fix it the night before. Just mix it all up really, really well, and that way the flavors mellow. And when you want to make your bowl, you take your bread, take a serrated knife, horizontally cut off the top third of the bread, and then cut out the inside. You could even do this with your hands. You can cut it out with a knife, or you can use your hands and just pull out the soft white dough. But you need to leave at least an inch thick shell of the bread on the inside. And then the bread you can cut, if you like, into cubes. And when you're trying to get it out, you can do that, and you can save them so they can scoop up the dip with the bread if you like, or you can just, you know, slice some, you know, a baguette if you want to do that, or have chips, whatever you prefer, so that you have the dippers, and then fill the bowl. When your company's there, just fill it right up, serve it right away, and you can also bake it if you want. If you want to have a hot dip, you can put it on an ungreased baking sheet, the bread bowl with the spinach dip inside of it, and bake it 350 degrees for 10 minutes. Or until it's slightly toasted. Oh, it's so good. And experiment with different seasonings. I think you'll find that it's really, really flavorful. Well, it looks like we're just about out of time here. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Life is full of adventures, full of wonderful opportunities waiting for you. I do hope you'll step up to the plate of action and say, I think I'll try one of those adventures just to see what it offers me in the way of new experience. Don't take life in a complacent attitude. There's a lot to be learned, a lot to be seen, and a lot to be enjoyed. We'll be back here, same time, same place, right here for the Donna Sebo Show. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to the Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.